I'm allowing us to
redeem
the time.
No problem, Senator. I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center. I'm representing low-income clients of the Oregon Law Center and also the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women, and appearing before you today in support of Senate Bill 23. Senate Bill 23 is similar to a bill that we filed last session in the House Judiciary Committee that directs the court system to draft and make available to the public the forms a person would need to file for a stalking protective order from the court on their own. When this bill failed to emerge last year from the House Judiciary Committee, the parties to it agreed to an informal work group during the interim, and this bill is the product of that work group. Involved in the work group were criminal defense lawyers, district attorneys, legal aid attorneys, court personnel, including judges and administrative personnel, sheriffs. We all participated in this group. And just let me describe a little bit about current law. Under current law, a stalking victim can seek an order through two ways, in one of two ways. One is by trying to get a citation from a law enforcement officer. The person fills out a form, gives it to a law enforcement officer. The law enforcement officer looks at it and then writes a citation to the alleged stalker saying that he or she must appear in court at on a particular date and time to show cause why a stalking protective order should not be entered. The other way, which is not very well defined in the law, is to go to court to get a stalking protective order from the court directly. In some counties, the police citation route works very well. I think Marion County is one of those counties. In other counties, it doesn't work at all. The police, for one reason or another, it's not a high enough priority. It doesn't come off often enough. Police officers are used to making arrests, not issuing citations of this kind. So it doesn't work in some places. And when that's not available, the person's only option is to go to court. And in many areas of the state, that means you have to have an attorney to do this for you because forms are not available at the courthouse. The low-income stalking victim in those places is simply pretty much out of luck in terms of trying to get protection from either the court or through the police officer citation route. What Senate Bill 23 is designed to do is to provide a way that those people can help themselves by getting forms from the courthouse and filing their own stalking protective order petition and getting an order on their own. The way that the bill works is the court administrator is charged with coming up with these forms, drafting the forms, and making them available. The advantage of this is that since these are forms that are made by the courts themselves, we would hope that they would be acceptable in courts all around the state. I would mention that there are courts who do this now, Multnomah County being a prime example. In other areas, a collaboration among district attorneys, crimes victims assistance personnel, domestic violence shelter personnel, and legal services have, in effect, made these forms available to victims. But and that doesn't work in all areas of the state. Senate Bill 23 does not change the standards the court considers in issuing stalking protective orders. The substantive law, in other words, has been left alone. The bill clarifies the procedure the court would use to issue an order, a procedure that, as I mentioned before, is not very well described in Chapter 30. It prescribes a straightforward civil action against the stalker in Section 1 for damages, and Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 set out the procedure to obtain the protective order. And it leaves alone the current procedure for stalking citations by police officers. So in short, this bill would empower victims to obtain protection on their own. It would make the procedure for obtaining an order by police citation or court order work better. I would mention that there are two amendments that we would suggest you consider. One is a technical amendment that involves requiring the court clerk to deliver a copy of the ex parte order and petition to the sheriff for service. That language is in the bill in the section about when, after the court issues a permanent order, but it got overlooked in issuing the ex parte order. The other amendment that I would mention is this was an amendment that was proposed to last session's bill, and it involves a situation where a respondent, in other words, the alleged stalker, is required by law to serve a paper, a court paper like a notice of appeal, on the petitioner. But there's some question the way that the law is written now about whether that conduct in itself could be considered to be a violation of the order. And this amendment would make it clear that if the person serves the document by mail, that the document that's being served is something that's legally required to be served on the petitioner, and the contents of the document are not intended to alarm or coerce the petitioner, then that contact would be allowed. So with those two amendments, we would support the bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Senator Ringo. Thank you, Mr.
David, I'm just looking under Section 2. We're looking at the intent requirements for the person who uses intentionally, knowingly, and recklessly, and I'm just wondering why recklessly? Under what circumstances would one recklessly run afoul of this?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, this is in current law. I've mentioned that, and I would suppose it would be a situation in which recklessness is generally defined to mean conduct that is likely to have a certain result, but the person ignores the risk of that result in doing the conduct. So I suppose it would be a situation where someone who thinks, let's say, he is in love with the petitioner, who has been told in no uncertain terms, no, I don't want anything to do with you, but continues on, might be guilty of reckless behavior.
Okay. I mean, it is current law in other places, I see. I see that back under Section 9, but go ahead. Okay.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ringo, I should explain, because I helped do this. What we did in this bill is what was Chapter 30, you can see, has been eliminated as to getting a protective order, so it would only be an action for damages, which the contemplation is that you get an attorney and do that. We broke out the protective order, and it's going to be a new section using all the same standards that are currently in ORS 30. So I just wanted to say that, because I'm sure, I mean, and when we went through this work group, many people had many suggestions about how to improve the stocking orders, and certainly I'm sure Mr. Niebel did not make a decision whether or not to keep recklessly.
Right, I understand. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
David, I'm looking at the testimony that's going to be submitted by Ingrid Swenson, and so I just want to hit you with a couple potential objections. What's your thoughts on the time limit? Shouldn't a stalking order have some time limit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, the work group considered that issue, and there are a number of people who think there is a good argument to be made that there should be time limits. However, the problem with time limits is if you impose a time limit, there would have to be a procedure for reinstituting the order if it's still needed, and we couldn't agree on how that procedure would work. We couldn't agree that the standards that the court would need to consider in renewing an order, whether it would require a new instance of stalking, what would happen if the order ran out and the person engaged in this behavior once again, would that be grounds for renewal? Would it have to be repeated again? It just raised a number of problems that the group could not agree on. I think that the reason why these were made permanent in the original bill under current law is that there was testimony when this law was passed that this behavior goes on over a long period of time. It doesn't tend to stop.
So, David, are you finished?
Yeah, I'm finished.
Okay. David, what's the process for extinguishing a stalking order?
Well, Mr. Chair, there is no process for dismissing one of these orders at this time.
You see that as a problem?
I can see. I don't really know what the problem would be unless.
Isn't this kind of an infringement on people's liberty?
Mr. Chair,
their rights to free speech, et cetera. There's some constitutional issues here, I would think.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would say that the legislature made a judgment that protection of a victim in this kind of a case, in these circumstances, is more important than
and the free speech rights of individuals.
Mr. Chair,
due process.
Well, Mr. Chair, we provide due process in establishing the order at the outset.
Right, but what happens when the circumstances change? There's no process by which you can dismiss one.
There is none under current law. I think that the reason that was not built in was that if the opportunity for seeking a modification or dismissal were in the law, that given the testimony that surrounded this bill when it was passed, that people who are guilty of this behavior might use that process to
protect their own rights, rights.
They would use the process to harass the victim.
Well, I guess I'm looking at this, and I understand because I'm very familiar with domestic violence and this whole kind of thing, but these individuals have constitutional rights. They have rights to due process. And just because they use the system doesn't seem to be offensive to me.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that the judgment was made, and you know, of course,
legislators make decisions all the time, and maybe it's never been appealed on those grounds. But if nobody has access, that seems rather silly.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that the reason that for the indefinite length of these orders and for not providing a modification procedure or a dismissal procedure is precisely protection of the victim, and that was the judgment that was made at the time.
Well, I understand that, but to not provide a way to extinguish one seems rather contrary to the whole concept of justice. But I'm just a neophyte at this. I'm just a cop, so
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Well, I was just going to express my... I tend to think you're right. I mean, I don't do family law. There's people in my building that do family law, and they come back and they tell me all these horrible stories. But I've just heard lots of examples where you've got husband and wife, or maybe they're not married, but maybe they have a relationship, and they get in a big fight, and there is abuse, and usually it's the woman who gets the stalking order. And then two or three weeks later, they make up, and especially if there's a kid involved, and then they reestablish their relationship. And then 4 or 5 months later, they have another blow-up. And yet, everything's been fine for a certain period of time, despite the fact of an outstanding stalking order. And so I guess I share the chair's concern. If there was a way to extinguish it so that it wouldn't be subject to manipulation, and I think that's the difficult thing. You want to make it easy for a stalking order when it's needed, but you also want the flexibility of extinguishing it or lifting it when that's appropriate.
I understand your point, Senator Ringo. I would point out that you might be there's another kind of ex parte procedure that is also available to ex parte or is available to ex parte litigants, the Family Abuse Prevention Act procedure, which is sort of aiming at a different kind of conduct, and the kind of conduct that you describe, which is domestic violence. Domestic violence among people who have an intimate relationship.
So you don't envision a stalking order under those circumstances. The hypothetical I gave would fall under that. It wouldn't fall under the stalking order.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think that that's right. I think that almost any attorney who would be advising a client under the circumstances you described would advise them to get a Family Abuse Prevention Act order.
Okay.
Which lasts for 1 year.
I see. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ringo, and to clarify, there are cases where people get both orders. There's not a prohibition against both orders.
Mm-hmm.
Some counties, I mean, that does happen. But, yes, I mean, that in a domestic relationship, I think when you look at the FAP order requires maybe a higher standard of abuse, for example, than the unwanted contacts, but it is available ex parte without the other side. The stalking order, you can get the temporary stalking order, but then you're going to have a opportunity to be heard to get and I think the language in the statute is for an indefinite period. And one of the interesting things is, as we all know, judges try to figure out what to do with statutes like this where it's pretty broad. And I think if you went to different counties, I think that there have been some that have tried to put time limits on them in some ways, and I think they don't know that that's whether they're really able to do that or not. It's a very open area mm-hmm. of the law. It's a very interesting area to try to, as you're saying, make these easy to obtain, but also have some ability to cabin them if they're abused.
Yeah. Thank you.
So does that not make it easy to abuse them also?
Mr. Chairman, I think it was it's a difficult area to get a consensus work group on, and we had, as Mr. Neagle said, we had people from every side of this, and I think what we came up with is the work group didn't want to make those policy decisions because I think everyone that worked on this order thought at least getting the citations the forms and things into court so that the court process is used. I think we'll find that a lot of people would agree with that part, even though they might have problems with other parts of it. The problem with it, of course, also is it's going to cost some amount of money, and that was the other issue, is trying to arrive at at the fiscal cost was difficult because, again, it's hard to predict, and I'm sure Mr. Neeb would say that was one of the main reasons why for example, the second hearing was not looked at more because it would cost more money. It's a difficult way.
Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nebo, I share some of the concerns that have been expressed here about timeline. And I'm real supportive of domestic violence protections and stalking orders. And I'm Is there some way to allow the court discretion to impose a timeline on the stalking order instead of leaving it open?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that could certainly be included in legislation. There's no question that you could do that. In other jurisdictions, I have to say that there are time limits on stalking orders. So this is being done in other jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. The concern about discretion in granting or denying these orders or in tailoring these orders is I think that some judges take these situations very seriously and understand the gravity of the conduct that's being prohibited. Other courts don't take these situations very seriously, and I think that the judgment of the legislature was, we're just for the sake of providing, we'd rather err on the side of protecting victims than give discretion to judges to deny protection and then have something terrible happen. So I think that the legislature, when it passed the statute initially, and what you see in the statute book now, reflects that judgment, and it says there is no discretion, basically, for judges to tailor these orders or to look outside the corners of the petition to examine the factual situation or to give the court discretion in granting or denying these orders when there's been a showing made by the petition that an order is appropriate.
I just feel like there needs to be some opportunity for periodic review because both Senator Ringo and Chair Minnis have touched on those situations where the stalking order can be manipulated. And I trust on, for the most part, that's not happening, but it does happen. And I just want to make sure everyone's protected here.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we'd be happy to work to try to address those kinds of concerns. And as Mr. Prince said, the work group considered a number of different kinds of scenarios of establishing time limits, creating a procedure for renewing orders in appropriate cases, allowing a respondent to come in to seek modification after a certain period of time and under certain circumstances, but we simply couldn't agree on what that would look like. And so we went with this stripped-down bill that basically provides the forms, simplifies the procedure, and does nothing more.
And we're supposed to fix it.
Well,
if we want to.
Perhaps we will. Senator
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I've been listening to the presentation. My impression of stalking orders is that they're pretty weak, a pretty lame way of offering protection. I think they create the illusion of protection more than the actual protection, because the enforcement of those orders depends on a contact from the target of the stalking with the police agency when they have an encounter. And then, of course, the police agencies have to respond. And that's demanding and difficult. But I also am curious to ask you about your personal experience as a law enforcement officer. When you pull a report on a subject, does that report from AIRS or RAINS or one of the law enforcement data system sharing programs tell you there's a stalking order in force on the subject?
Yeah, I actually have never encountered that. I'm assuming that LEDS would show, law enforcement data system would show an existing stalking order. I would assume that that's the case.
Mr. Chairman, members, it does show if there's a stalking order in LEDS. Okay. It show.
Does that... I'm wondering what the impression of the officer receiving that report is of the person that has a stalking order. And it could be years old. But it would seem to me that it would characterize, in my mind, a person as being, you know, unstable, emotional, and possibly volatile, maybe violent. So I guess I'm, you know, I'm concerned in both directions. I think if the community is telling us they need to have a strengthening of the stalking laws and the protective orders, we ought to try to do that, because I think that's probably necessary. At the same time, I can understand that if these things exist interminably in the system, and and I can't believe it doesn't form some kind of an impression in the minds of law enforcement officers that pull a report and see a stalking order. I wonder how long a person should stay under that indictment. So I guess I'm really torn. I want the protections, and if we need to strengthen those, we ought to. But I do see the wisdom of getting some kind of a off-ramp here built into the system so that years from the issuance of the order, after the need is gone, a person still isn't being characterized as potentially threatening violent individual in society. And can you address that issue for me?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrielli, let me emphasize that the proposal before you is not to change the substantive law of stalking as it is. With respect to your concern about branding someone, I think that the testimony, I go back to the testimony surrounding this bill when it was passed in the early 90s, which was that stalking is a behavior that goes on over a long period of time. People had been stalked for years, literally, and could do nothing about it. And so that was the impetus to make these orders last indefinitely. I think if there were a way to renew them after, say, 5 years with just a petition that said this order is set to expire, I am still in fear of this person stalking me, without having to show that there had been another incident, because after all, that person has been restrained from any of the behavior that formed the basis for the complaint in the first place. So, and if he or she had engaged in any of that behavior, one would hope that that person would have been arrested and charged with violation of the order. So one would not expect to have had additional instances of stalking after the order was entered. So the standards for renewal, I think, would be something we'd have to make sure that you can say, I still have a reasonable fear of this person. If there's evidence and the person is satisfied that the person has moved out of state or has had counseling, or I don't know what kind of showing, what would satisfy the victim that the person no longer constituted a threat, then he or she wouldn't have to renew at that point. But we would be concerned with the standards required to renew.
Mm-hmm. Are you finished? Okay, Senator Ringo.
I guess I just wanted to step back for a minute, Mr. Chair, and comment or maybe clarify that it sounds like the question of stalking orders raises lots of thorny problems. But really, we're not, unless we're going to open that up and really analyze all of them, is what we're trying to do is make it easier for people to get them that can't afford an attorney. I mean, really, that's what this bill is about, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, that's exactly what this bill is about. That's right.
Except that, you know, I tell you what, I take very seriously issues of constitutional rights of both victims and suspects, whether it's criminal or civil. I mean, to me, this raises thorny issues. But there are seriously flawed issues, in my opinion, with respect to the constitutional rights and privileges of citizens of the United States. Now, when you talk about stalking orders, things said, word, deed, conduct, some of those actions are protected under the Constitution. And it's baffling to me when those actions, speech, now becomes criminal or subject to a civil order to cease and desist. And I think it's a very serious issue. And to have a process in law that forces someone to not do something they would otherwise be constitutionally protected to do is a very serious and weighty matter. Now, obviously, to the extent that it rises to the level that someone's going to harm someone, which is, I think, what we're trying to get at, there's got to be a nexus there. And when that harm or that threat no longer exists, there also has to be a process by which the order can go away to protect the constitutional civil rights of citizens. I mean, it just seems so. I know we're trying to make it easier. I don't know that I want to make it easier when there are so many other huge flaws in the law.
Mr. Chair, I think that it's important in this context to point out that the Supreme Court, or, well, I guess the Court of Appeals, has considered constitutional challenges to the stalking procedure and stalking orders. I'm not exactly sure that they've confronted the indefinite period issue directly.
But the courts aren't the only parts of the government, separation of powers, that protect the constitutional rights of individuals. Just because some crafty lawyer hasn't made the same argument doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Because you have to have standing, right?
That's correct.
You have to have
an
issue of controversy or whatever you lawyers call it, you know, or get it into court. I mean, and that's why legislatures exist, so people can come in here and petition and say, hey, this law sucks. I don't know if you've ever been in the Parliament building in London or not, in the House chambers in the Parliament building, but there's a fascinating thing that I saw when I visited there. Behind the seat that the speaker sits in is a big leather envelope that hangs from the back of the chair. And I remember asking specifically, what is that? Why is that there? And in England, that was the place that the citizens could come and drop their petitions to the government in. And it sits high up on that chair, specific because the Speaker of the House or the Parliament is a high position. And this legislature is a high position. And it's not something to be manipulated. And we're here to represent the constitutional rights of all of the citizens, not just those we're afraid of. So,
Mr. Chair, just for purposes of discussion, my concern is more the manipulation of the system. I mean, I greatly value constitutional rights, but I think the constitutional right to follow somebody around and harass somebody it doesn't receive that much protection. And if so, I'm not sure under what amendment. I don't think it's.
But it should be arguable and defensible. You can't just simply assert that something exists and not demonstrate factually that it doesn't exist. For me to assert that so and so forth is doing such and so forth, and this has an impact on me, and therefore the court should step in.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in knowing whether there is a problem with that happening right now.
Right. We're actually going to do that. We're going to pull some of these petitions from various courts and get some examples of how they've been used and where they are. And the other, you know, the fact appears to me obvious that we have a bunch of these orders that are sitting out there in existence that we wouldn't know whether they have any relevance now or not.
I guess, if you, we lawyers, quote-unquote, always balance things. It's always a balancing. And on the one side of it, we're balancing the need for people, and usually women, who are feeling harassed and threatened, physically threatened,
right,
their need for safety, which is legitimate. And on the other thing we're balancing against that is the rights that you're talking about.
Correct.
And it's hard to know what is the greater problem.
Correct.
So I just...
But, Senator, I think you would agree with me. The courts deal with facts. They deal with evidence.
They
don't deal with conjecture, innuendo.
Oh, that's right.
Mr. Chairman, if I may point out one thing about the stalking procedure under current law and under this amendment, still is that there is a hearing in every case. So it's not that the court is just simply looking at a paper that's brought before them. They do that ex parte to issue basically a show cause order to the respondent. But the respondent does get his or her day in court, and the court gets to consider whether or not an order is justified at the initial hearing.
It doesn't. Judges to have discretion to dismiss them.
Well, the judges do have discretion to dismiss at the hearing stage.
But once they're issued, or to set time limits. You understand? It's a balance issue. That's all I'm looking for. Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Niebel, the respondent has to show up. It doesn't have to show up. So if the respondent doesn't show up, court can still issue an order. So they've foregone their day in court because they've refused to show up, correct?
That's correct.
And I can't feel sorry for someone who chooses not to do that because they've been given the proper notice and they've just chosen not to show up for whatever reason. So, I agree with you there that they have that protection to get their day in court, but then we have the other issue about when does the judge have discretion to dismiss or review the order. But have
all
you
right.
heard from Ingrid Swenson yet?
Oh, we did actually the other day. She submitted her biggest testimony in writing for us.
Okay.
I don't know if she's here.
She is.
We could hear from her again if she wants to rebut. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your patience with me.
Lorena
Reynolds.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lorena Reynolds, and I'm an attorney with Legal Aid Services of Oregon in the Albany Regional Office. We represent low-income survivors of domestic violence and stalking in Linn and Benton counties. I've been litigating stalking protective orders in those counties for about 4 years, including in the circuit courts and at the Court of Appeals. I wanted to talk first about the bill as it's drafted now and then maybe address some of the issues about current case law and how it's defining stalking protective orders and the circumstances under which you can get them. In Linn County, we were having so much trouble with the citation route, the police citation route, that the circuit court actually asked that we no longer use that route. They developed a local form that's available in the courthouse at no cost to petitioners, and that system is working really well. People go to the courthouse in the morning, they fill out the forms, they see a judge ex parte, and the judge then rules on their petition whether or not to issue a temporary order and sets a hearing. In Benton County, however, the court wasn't as interested in doing that. And even though the police citation route continues not to be a viable option, it's not consistently available for folks that go to the police department. Sometimes they're issued when there isn't any factual basis for it, and sometimes it's not issued when there is a factual basis. And in Benton County, if you go in and say, I need a stalking protective order, it's going to depend on what clerk is available. Sometimes you'll be told, oh, go up to the district attorney's office. And the district attorney's office then might tell you, we don't do that up here. Or they might provide you with a form that Legal Aid has worked with the Benton County Family Violence Council to have made available on the third floor. The last time that I had somebody go up to the third floor to get that, the form wasn't properly copied. It only had every other page available. So when they tried to file that with the court, obviously that wasn't enough to be able to get in the door. So in Benton County, it's the self-petition route. Unless you get yourself to an attorney, which is usually Legal Aid, and that's located in Albany, 22 miles away, it's effectively not an option for you to self-petition the court for a stalking protective order. So that's the general reason why I think this particular bill, SB 23, needs to be in place to have those forms available at the courthouse consistently to everybody every day, so it doesn't depend on what clerk you get or whether or not you can find an attorney that's willing to provide you with the forms. Mr. Chair, did you want me to cover some of the issues that of the constitutional issues, or did you want me to take questions on that?
Why don't you do that? I understand you have a case or something you want to tell us about.
Well, as far as the time limits go, Delgado versus Souter, I don't have the citation in front of me because I wasn't prepared on the constitutional issues, but it does specifically address the issue of the court's inherent power to dismiss these. So in case law, we do have, you know, we don't have the actual procedure, how to go to court, what forms to file, things like that, but the court does have the inherent power to come back and dismiss these later on. And at least in Linn and Benton counties, that's the general practice.
So how does one get into court to dismiss one or get it removed?
Well, in Benton County, Mr. Chair, in Benton County, it's very informal. You could just send a letter to the judge saying that you would like a hearing on the matter. In Linn County, you'd probably have to file a piece of paper that said that it was a motion to dismiss.
Okay. All right. So we'll get a copy of that case. Go through it. See if we can do a survey of other cases if there are relevant cases. So, just asking counsel, it seems to me that the Judicial Department can already do this if they wanted to apply a statewide standard to the courts. So, but we have a law being asked for, and they already have the authority to do it. So it's kind of fascinating to find ourselves in this position.
Well, Mr. Chair, the work group couldn't come to an agreement on the procedure to put in place. That's the basic problem.
How many lawyers do you have in the room?
Lots.
I have no idea, Mr. Chair.
Too many.
That's kind of a joke. Sorry. So, okay. Well, I think I want to take a look at this, and I'm going to ask counsel to take a look at the whole array of issues here. We may want to move this bill along, but then work on this in some other form, or work in this bill. But I'm going to take my time a little bit with this and make sure I understand it. And those folks in the work group, I'd like you all to think about if there's another way to do this that might be better and cost less. Clearly, police officers can issue these things. I'm just wondering if maybe that's not the route.
Mr. Chair, it hasn't been my experience that is a route that has been working.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're already familiar with the DV restraining order issues and mandatory arrests and all those kind of things.
Well, Mr. Chair, in the domestic violence arena, mostly what they do is refer people to the courthouse for ex parte hearings on the Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining orders that are available. I think that this, because a lot of the stalking protective order law is found in complex case law, like the constitutional protections that you were talking about before are found in Rangel, and I think that even for people who spend a large portion of their case time working on stalking protective order issues, it's very difficult to understand which cases there's First Amendment protections for or not.
Would you think it's time to maybe review that stuff and see whether or not we need to include some in statute and codify some of it?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure it would impact my practice. I think the law is so evolving that if we codified it now, we'd end up codifying it again every time.
But isn't that the nature of the law? Mm-hmm. I mean, don't we have to codify it from time to time to bring it all together? I mean, the traffic code is a complete and total mess, and no one in the legislature has taken a good hard look at it. We probably should have an entire work group in the interim to restructure the whole thing. It's in bad shape. You don't want to be part of that.
No.
All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on this issue? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing. It's in Bill 23. For those waiting for 113, I'm going to not hear that one today. So if you have other places you want to go, you can do that. And then I think Amy Holm, you're here from Multnomah County on which bill? 114. So let's do a public hearing on Senate Bill 114. Are you first up?
I'm not sure.
Oh, okay, Michael Livingston. Okay. You know who you are. Look here.
Chairman, members of the committee and council. For the record, my name is Michael Livingston. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Justice in the Appellate Division. Senate Bill 114 clarifies the current provisions of a statute in the Juvenile Delinquency Code 419C 261 subsection 2 which concerns the juvenile court's authority to dismiss or set aside a delinquency petition. The statute currently provides that the court may set aside or dismiss a petition, a delinquency petition, in furtherance of justice after considering the circumstances of the youth and the interest of the state in adjudicating the petition. The word youth in that statute is a term of art and is defined in the delinquency code as a person who is alleged to have committed a delinquent act. And read just in that, in those terms, the statute appears to authorize a juvenile court to dismiss a delinquency petition before it's adjudicated, because that's the status of a person identified as a youth. The Oregon Supreme Court, in the Dreyer case, which is cited at the bottom of my written testimony, held that that statute authorizes the dismissal of a delinquency petition after the petition has been adjudicated. In other words, after the juvenile court has held a hearing and decided whether the facts alleged in the delinquency petition are correct. Without getting into the complexities of the legal argument, just as a matter of logic and chronology, it simply doesn't make sense that you can dismiss a petition after the petition has been adjudicated. In terms of common sense, whatever deficiencies or challenges to be made to the petition really are merged into the adjudication of the petition. And so the question arises, what is the legal effect, or what can be the legal effect of the dismissal of a petition after the petition has already been adjudicated? For example, does it by consequence dismiss the adjudication? And the particular question that arose in the Dreyer case, where the court held that you could dismiss the petition after it had been adjudicated, was whether the dismissal of a petition in a sex offense case had the effect of expunging that offense from the juvenile's record. And the reason that was an issue is because in ORS 419A260, this legislature has decided that a certain list of offenses, including among them sex offenses, cannot be adjudicated. Now, the Supreme Court held in Dreyer that it was premature to decide in that case whether the dismissal of the petition would have the effect of expunging the youth's record on the offense. So you could say, well, what's the problem here, because the Dreyer case didn't say that it had that effect. Well, the problem is the one I identified earlier, is there's no clear recognition or understanding of just what the legal effect is of dismissing the petition. And both with respect to dismissing the petition and dismissing the adjudication, which Ms. Holmes-Haynes will talk about, this lack of clarity in what the legal effect is of these dismissals is repeatedly the cause of litigation and uncertainty about what the status of the person is. So what Senate Bill 114 does is address a very narrow aspect of that uncertainty by simply saying that once it's adjudicated, the petition can't be dismissed as long as the adjudication is there. Before adjudication, it can be dismissed for the reasons stated in 419C-261. And I think, although the Supreme Court disagreed with this position in Dreyer, I think that's probably what this legislature intended anyway, because it used the word youth in the statute, which means a person who has not yet been adjudicated, a person who is alleged to be within the juvenile court's jurisdiction under the delinquency statutes. And that very simply is the scope and impact of 114. I understand that Amy Holmes-Haynes, the district attorney in the juvenile section of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, has proposal or suggestion that the scope and focus be expanded.
Okay. I was going to say for the committee, if you recall last session, Senate Bill 370, when we reauthorized sex offender registration, we did some interesting stuff there by giving the sex offender youths that are adjudicated sex offenders that they would then have the privilege of petitioning the court to not be a registered sex offender in perpetuity. And we flipped the onus there to require that the district attorney become responsible for proving that the child is or should be required to continue registration. So the district attorneys didn't like that. But part of this, the justification for doing that, had to do with the fact that judges were using a dependency as a way of avoiding registration. So to some extent, statutorily, we've already tried to resolve some of this problem. So, Ms. Haney.
Thank you. Good morning, Senator Minnis and committee members and council. My name is Amy Holmes Hain. I'm the senior deputy district attorney supervising the juvenile unit of the Multnomah County DA's office. I've been a deputy DA since 1987. I've been in charge of our juvenile unit for about 6 years. And throughout my prosecutorial career, I've been heavily involved in the prosecution of sex crimes, both adult sex crimes and sex crimes committed by juveniles. And what I would like to do is to just take a step back a bit and provide a little bit of historical context for this issue, because it's a fairly complicated issue, and then explain that while I support the concept of Senate Bill 114, I don't actually support the bill as written, because I don't think it goes far enough to address the underlying problem here. As I'm sure you are all aware, the juvenile court has much more discretion flexibility in resolving juvenile court delinquency cases than adult criminal court does. And there are good reasons for that. I think it's based upon a recognition that there are significant differences between juveniles and adults, and the court needs to have the ability to look at the individual circumstances of a youth and make decisions about what's going to happen to that youth, taking into account all of the important circumstances of the case and the youth's situation. In 1995, through Senate Bill 1, the legislature made a decision to impose some restrictions on that flexibility that the juvenile court has when it comes to the handling of very serious offenses, particularly sex offenses. And I believe that that stemmed from a concern that the juvenile court was not taking sex crimes committed by juveniles adequately seriously. And so a couple of things that the legislature did to try to rein in judicial discretion in this area was, first of all, make it clear that sex crimes committed by juveniles should not be expunged from a juvenile's record. In other words, if you commit a sex crime as a juvenile, that offense should follow you into your future, because it's important for the public to be on notice that you molested a child as a teenager, and that the public should have the right to know that. And that was not true historically. Those offenses could be expunged. Another thing that the legislature did was it restricted the court's authority, or attempted to restrict the court's authority, to grant informal resolutions of those offenses. One of the things that the juvenile court had done historically, to the frustration of prosecutors and victims' advocates, was in essentially divert sex crimes by dismissing the petitions and agreeing that they could be handled informally without the establishment of an actual record in the court of the conduct of the youth. And so the legislature established restrictions, or a new process called formal accountability agreements, which are a type of informal resolution that the court can order. But the legislature said that those informal resolutions cannot be granted in sex cases without the state's agreement. So again, recognizing that to allow an informal resolution of a sex case is a serious matter, and that the state's interest in seeing youths adjudicated for these offenses is an important interest. Unfortunately, from the state's perspective, the bench, which I have a great deal of respect for, particularly the juvenile court bench, found a way to do an end run around the legislative intent to make sure that sex crimes against juveniles are adjudicated. And that is to exercise its authority that it has in two separate parts of the code. One part of the code allows the court to dismiss a petition at any time prior to adjudication. In sex cases, the court has to make written findings about why it's doing that, but that isn't really a restriction on judicial authority, because the court will always be able to articulate reasons why it wants to dismiss a petition pre-adjudication. And when we mean pre-adjudication, we mean pre-trial, prior to the establishment of the facts and a finding of the juvenile equivalent of guilt. The other way that the court has done an end run around this legislative intent, from our perspective, is to do what's called post-adjudication dismissal. So in other words, we have a trial, the youth is found guilty in juvenile court, if you will, or the youth admits guilt, enters an admission or a plea, and has been convicted, if you will, adjudicated in juvenile court of a sex crime, several years down the road, the court can simply take that adjudication away. It can say, I'm dismissing this case now, even though the youth was found guilty of this crime. And it can do that by simply saying, I'm dismissing the case, but it can also go back and vacate its original jurisdictional order. In other words, the order that it entered, finding the youth within the jurisdiction of the court and guilty of the crime, the court can simply set it aside. And so the effect of that is as if the youth was never found guilty of this crime. We don't really know yet what the legal impact is of the court doing such a thing. It's probably likely that if a youth were to then move for expungement of his juvenile record, he would be entitled to that because he could argue that, well, you know, this adjudication was taken away, so I was never really convicted of it, so my record should be cleansed of the fact that any of this happened. And to us, that's not in the interest of public safety. This bill attempts to provide some restrictions on judicial authority to do that post-adjudication dismissal, saying that the court can't dismiss a petition that's already been adjudicated. The problem with it is, though, it says the court can't do that unless the adjudication has been set aside under 419C610. That's not a restriction on the court's authority because the court has unlimited discretion under 419C610 to set aside that adjudication. It's a complicated argument, and I'm hoping you're following me, but the bottom line is that in order to really restrict the court's authority to take away a conviction that's already been entered in a juvenile sex case, the legislature really needs to put some restrictions on the court's ability to vacate a jurisdictional order that's already been entered, and this bill doesn't really do that. So that's our concern about it. Unfortunately, this is not an issue about which any sort of work group could ever or has ever been able to reach consensus because the polls are extremely opposed to one another in this area. I'm sure you'll be hearing soon from lawyers who represent youths in these cases, and their view is that the court should have the authority to take away an adjudication of a sex case, if you will, because it's not fair to tag a youth as a sex offender into his adult years if he's done well on supervision. And we just disagree with that.
Right. Well, we set up a process specific to allow a youth to be relieved of that responsibility.
Right. And to comment on that, the legislature did pass a bill to provide some relief from sex offender registration because, as you're all aware, I'm sure, it used to be that sex offender registration for juveniles was for life. Now there's a process by which relief for registration can be obtained if the youth has done well. Our hope in the court was that the fact that that relief is available would persuade the court not to do this vacation of the original jurisdictional order and the taking away of the case altogether, and that hasn't been the impact, unfortunately. Courts are still going ahead and dismissing cases post-adjudication and vacating jurisdictional orders in spite of the fact that the legislature provided relief from sex offender registration.
Okay, thank you. Senator Walker, I think, had a question. Senator Farioli and then Senator Rico.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Holmes-Hain, you've talked about sex offender cases. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out why a judge would vacate an order post-adjudication, because expungement is available for a juvenile to expunge their record when they get to a certain age. Is there any other circumstance that a judge does this in other than sex cases?
You have a couple of questions in there. Expungement is not available for juvenile sex offenses. Relief from registration is, but if you're adjudicated in juvenile court for a sex crime, that's not an expungible offense. And so what the court's thinking, as I understand it, is that the court, I think, is confused about where we are in our state of knowledge about the risk to reoffend that juveniles continue to present into the future if they've been adjudicated on, if they've committed a sex crime as a juvenile. They want to kind of leave the book open, if you will, for the possibility of eliminating this offense from a person's record if they feel convinced that the person is likely not to reoffend again in the future. And unfortunately, the state of knowledge in this area is very poor because we've really only been studying juvenile sex offenders in social science as a class for about the last 8 years or so. So there aren't any great studies which tell us well, juveniles are less likely to reoffend than adults, or these are factors that you can look at with a juvenile and say, this one is more dangerous than another with regard to sex crimes. But the court has been wanting to err on the side of the juvenile in the sense of not wanting to tag them as a sex offender into their adult years, because they just feel that it's a weighty thing to do to a person's future. And so that's the motivation, I think. And so while the court could engage in this process of dismissing an adjudicated case with any offense under the juvenile code, we really only see it in sex cases as a practical matter because the court feels like the consequences of an adjudication for a sex offense are so serious. From the state's perspective, those consequences are serious because the conduct is serious, and those consequences should attach to an adjudication for a sex offense, which was the legislature's intent in requiring sex offender registration, submission of DNA samples, making sex crimes non-expungible. The legislature agrees that these are serious offenses which shouldn't just disappear from a youth's record. Unfortunately, the court has found a way around that. And so we do think that that needs to be addressed. Our position is that this bill just doesn't go far enough to really do that.
Okay, well, I appreciate your answer, and I've seen some heads in the background going up and down and this way. So I think there's going to be some disagreement with you, and I'll be looking forward to hearing that. But thank you for answering my question.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, could I follow up on that? I have an example of a particular case in response to your question. It's a case, the Tyree case, T-Y-R-E-E. In that case, the juvenile was adjudicated under 419C, the delinquency statute, based on his admission to a first-degree rape. It would be rape if he had been an adult. 2 years later, he sought and asked the court to set aside that adjudication for reasons not related to the merits of the adjudication. In other words, he didn't come in and say, I've got newly discovered evidence that shows I didn't do it. Of course, he admitted it anyway. And he didn't come in and say, this adjudication is constitutionally infirm, which would be two grounds to set it aside. What his argument was to the court was that this should be set aside because I've successfully completed my probation. Under ORS 419C610, which gives the court authority to set aside adjudications, that is sufficient reason. And so in that case, the court set aside the adjudication for reasons, again, unrelated to the merits of it. In other words, the finding of beyond a reasonable doubt he did this. And it's another example, like the Dreyer case, where the state, because of the uncertainty about the legal effect of that setting aside, was forced to appeal just to make sure that wasn't a de facto expungement that Ms. Holmes-Hain was talking about. On appeal, the Court of Appeals said that because the order setting aside the adjudication was prospective, that is, it operated from the date he completed probation, that it didn't operate as an expunction. But it also said that it did relieve this person of the responsibility to register as an offender, because under the statute that requires that, the registration obligation ends if the adjudication is reversed or vacated. This is not a situation where that adjudication was reversed. Reversed usually is a term of art which means for legal or other constitutional error, and vacated. And I think this case raises the question, for the same reasons that Ms. Hain talked about, whether the legislature had in mind when it used the word vacated to say you no longer have to register a dismissal or a setting aside of an adjudication on these grounds, that is, unrelated to the merits of the adjudication. I apologize for the delay, but I thought that might help a specific example in response to your question. Thank you.
Well, I think this whole area of law is evolving as we become a little bit more knowledgeable. Clearly, we set up the process last session because there were problems with youth being registered in perpetuity. But again, I was under the impression that the court would be wise enough to perhaps change some of their patterns, too, and apparently that isn't happening. So, okay, good. Senators, I'm sorry, I'm going down the line here. They'll get back to him. Senator Farrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I just have a request of the senators, and that is often I think all of our offices get requests from individuals seeking some relief, some post-conviction relief, or some ability to ameliorate the requirement for them to register as sex offenders for life. And I was not aware that there was mechanisms in the statutes that would allow that. And it would be helpful for me to have a briefing on the process and any materials that I might be able to forward to constituents that contact our office with that question.
Sure. I'm happy to provide that. I should let you know that there are some working groups. There's a working group out there now which is continuing to look at refining the process for seeking relief from registration to answer some unanswered questions that still exist after the bill which was passed last session. So as the chair said, this is an evolving area of the law, but I think everyone is supportive of the idea of relief for registration in some circumstances, provided that there's a good process in place for that. Our concern about the current situation is that the court's authority to simply set aside the original adjudication is an end run around that process also, because if the court vacates the original jurisdictional order, they're simply relieved from registration, period, without having to go through the process which the legislature set up, which requires that certain things be proved and that there be evaluations available to determine the person's current risk to reoffend, et cetera.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I almost hate to ask, but I guess I do want to know a little bit more detail what you mean when you say juvenile sex crime. Are you talking 16 and 17-year-old boys committing rape? I mean, what really are we talking about?
We wouldn't be talking about anyone age 15 or older, because those offenses would be handled in adult court under Measure 11. So
okay.
Those are for felony sex offenses. But we are talking about
so 14 and
14
under.
And under who commit any sex crime under the code. And that starts at the top with rape 1, which we think of as forcible rape, or rape of a very young child, sodomy 1, you know, which is oral or anal sex against a very young child or by force. It includes sexual abuse, which is sexual touching, and on down from there. Felony and misdemeanor level offenses.
Are 14-year-olds these days having consensual sex, and does that fall into that category?
14-year-olds these days are having consensual sex, but there are defenses in the code for sex between, you know, if you will, consenting parties who are within 3 years of age of one another. So we don't charge cases where two 14-year-olds are having sex consensually with one another, typically. We're really talking here about cases which any one of you would consider to be serious sex crimes. Now, there are misdemeanor-level offenses included in all of this as well. Sex abuse in the third degree is simply touching somebody sexually without their consent, regardless of the age of the victim. So that is included in the category of sex crimes, which can't be expunged from someone's record. And so the concern there, I think, is that which motivated the bill about registration last session is, well, for some of these lower-level offenses, it really seems like somebody ought to have relief from lifetime registration. And so that was why one of the reasons why we had the bill which was passed to allow for that. Our perspective is that the legislature has already said that sex crimes committed by juveniles are serious and need to be a matter of record. And so, unfortunately, this process the court has implemented is a way around that.
Thank you. Senator Stark?
That question got really to the heart of what I was concerned about. But I guess I am really struggling with the issue that those juveniles were adjudicated under Measure 11, the 16-year-old having consensual sex for the 13-year-old, one time going to prison for it. It's an issue that's with the change in sexual mores that has occurred in our society over my lifetime. It's just it's troubling to me that these cases, many of them even go to court, and yet I know that the 13-year-old going on 20 who's had consensual sex with that 16-year-old is perhaps needs some protection. It's a troubling issue. But it's outside of what we're looking at here, and so I thank you for the explanation you gave, Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Senator. Most of your cases deal with issues of forcible compulsion or patterns of behavior that are different than just statutory rape, necessarily.
I would say, Chairman Minnis, that that's not exactly accurate. Most of the sex cases that come through our system involve through juvenile court don't involve forcible compulsion. And when we talk about forcible compulsion in the law, what we're talking about is what you think of as the attack sort of rape, where the suspect attacks the victim resists as much as possible. What we're talking about is typically a teenager having sexual contact with a very young child. And those children are often family members. They can be younger brothers and sisters. They can be cousins. They can be, these can be babysitters sexually abusing children in the care of the daycare provider. So they're almost always non-forcible in that sense. They involve what we think of as sexual molestation, including, you know, rape and sodomy of young children by teenagers.
Right. But not the same forcible compulsion that we would tend to envision in adult rape.
Right.
Cases.
We do sometimes see those cases, but they're pretty rare in juvenile court. We have seen them. One of the things that's concerning to us is that what we find once these kids are adjudicated and in treatment is almost always we find out that they have many more victims than we realized at first, or many more sexual contacts than we realized at first. In all my years, I can only think of a handful of youths who, after going through treatment and taking polygraphs and such, we really believed only to have the sexual contact for which they were adjudicated. In almost every case, we see multiple victims, multiple sexual contacts, many more than we dreamed that we had.
Okay, Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. I think you said this, but I want to be clear. There really isn't data to show what long-term threat those kinds of offenders pose to society.
There's been a lot of work to try to collect what's out there to help inform the legislative work groups that have been working on this issue. And there are some studies which purport to say that juvenile sex offenders are more amenable to treatment than adults, and that their risk to reoffend is less than adult sex offenders. The problem with those studies is that detecting reoffending is extremely difficult and is not something that has really received a lot of scrutiny historically in the way that juvenile sex offenders have been treated in therapy. For example, you know, one of the most important tools in detecting reoffending in juvenile sex offenders, or adult sex offenders for that matter, is the use of polygraphs as part of treatment. Polygraphs as part of treatment has only been part of the landscape in juvenile sex offender treatment very recently.
But the bottom line is, right, you've got a situation where you're prosecuting a 13-year-old for having problems with daycare.
Right.
You don't know whether when that person is 30 or 40 years old, what sort of behavioral problems they're going to have or whether they're going to be a threat.
We don't.
We don't.
And so I think that the big disagreement kind of at the core of this issue, or one of the big disagreements, is the state's perspective tends to be more to err on the side of caution. You know, if at age 13 or 14 you sexually abused a 3-year-old, our view is that should be something the public has a right to know.
Even though you have no evidence that person's a threat?
Well, our view is that if you sexually abused a 3-year-old, you're a threat. And then what we typically find in treatment is that you didn't just sexually abuse one 3-year-old.
I understand that, okay, but I'm talking 30 years later.
Right.
You want to stigmatize somebody for 30 years and beyond, even though you have no evidence that they're a threat.
What I would say about that is that if we're able to determine that a person's not a threat, under the current law, you have the right to apply for relief from sex offender registration. And that, I think, was what motivated the bill, which Chairman Minnis mentioned earlier, is that there should be a way to examine where you are in the future. And that was a well-thought-out process, and it makes sense to us. Our concern here is that the court is backdooring and getting around that process, which was established.
Understand. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Livingston. Just if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo. The problem is that we're not, in these cases, we don't operate in a legal vacuum, because the policy choices to which you're referring have already been made for us anyway by the legislature in the non-expunction provisions 419A 260 and in the sex offender registration. I do think, and your example of the lifetime following the record brings it up, I do think that there certainly could be and should be a reevaluation of the expunction statute. post-Measure 11. The expunction statute that's in existence now, barring expunction in these cases, was enacted before Measure 11. And so, as you noted, the folks in juvenile court now who are involved in these cases are 14 and under. And so perhaps a reassessment of this current structure is in order. Another way it might be reassessed is there's no distinction now in the expunction statute for an adjudication that was set aside for reasons related to the merits. In other words, if the adjudication is set aside because it's unconstitutional, there's no provision that allows that to be expunged for that reason, even though it's otherwise barred. But my point is, in saying this, is that these are things that, given the current legal structure, this uncertainty about the effect of the dismissal of a petition and the effect of the dismissal of an adjudication causes us to have to go to court every time and through this appeal process to find out if it really does work in expunction. Because if we don't appeal, then it may be too late. If you see my point, if we don't appeal, then that order in that case becomes the law of that case. So it's although these policy issues that we've been talking about certainly are raised by this proposal, I think it's important to remember we're operating under the current legal structure, which has the uncertainties that I defined. Thank you.
May I just make one more comment? Sure. To follow up on your question? I think another concern that the state has in that this provision, which is 419C610, which allows the court to modify or set aside any order that it makes, including to set aside a jurisdictional order in a sex case, there's no structure around that. There are no standards for the court to apply. And that's a frustration for the state because the court is really not, you know, we like to think that we work in a judicial environment where there are rules about how the court applies its discretion. Here, the discretion is completely unlimited. The court may make a decision to vacate an order like that for good reasons or for bad reasons, and because there's no real structure around that discretion, there's really no remedy for the state in terms of a right of appeal of that decision, because we would have to show really gross abuse of discretion in order to challenge a decision like that. And so another option is to try to find a way to establish some rules around how this discretion could be exercised.
Thank you. No other questions? We'll have the defense side.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Since the state always wants the last word, we'll stick around in case you have further questions.
We'll give you a chance for rebuttal.
Thanks.
There's no redirect.
All right. Now, Ingrid, you and Kathy are going to come together, apparently. Who's the lead on this one?
Oh, that would be me.
That would be
Mr. Chair. For the record, Kathy Berger from the Juvenile Rights Project. I've been representing juveniles in delinquency proceedings for the last 12 years. I've actually got to the point that I'm now representing kids. I can say that I've been doing it as long as they've been alive, unfortunately. I think the major premise that Ms. Holmes-Hain talked about and Mr. Livingston talked about with the juvenile court is that the court is given great discretion, much more discretion than a criminal court judge is given. And the reason for that is because of the main reason for juvenile court. When we adjudicate a juvenile in juvenile court, we then give them a right to treatment and give them treatment to then remedy the situation. We do not consider juvenile court adjudications as criminal convictions because we acknowledge the fact that kids are developing and they're going through different developmental stages, and therefore they are more amenable to treatment and more amenable to actually solving their problems and going on to be, you know, upstanding citizens. In fact, it's quite interesting because if you look at the number of kids that are involved in the juvenile court process, it's like a funnel in that there are kids that, you know, just having a contact with a police officer, that's it. That's going to be enough for them. You know, being brought home by a police officer some night and having mom and dad scold them is going to be enough to stop them from doing any illegal behavior. Then there's kids that need maybe a more formal diversion process where there's a little bit more of a formal thing that they have to go to. But at each stage of the juvenile court process, as we get more and more formal and we get more and more restrictive of a use of liberty, what we see are kids dropping out of the system and not committing any more crimes. And that's important because it goes to the whole court's idea of why we need to look at whether lifetime registration and perhaps expunction is necessary for kids that commit any kind of acts, including sex offenses. Now, Ms. Holmes-Hain told you that there are studies that have been shown, and I believe last session the Oregon Youth Authority actually presented at the at a hearing on Senate Bill 370, which was the bill that ultimately, or 730, I think it was 730, which actually finally gave relief to juveniles for sex offender out of sex offender registration. Now, it's important to note at this point, well, anyway, the Oregon Youth Authority reported about some of those studies showing that juveniles who are given quality sex offender treatment are less likely to reoffend than adults. And that's because they are amenable to treatment because they are developing and they can be taught. When you start to become looking at adults, our personalities become more and more fixed. It's harder for us to make changes in who we base in our basic personality structure. But it's pretty easy for most kids, not all kids, but most kids, to make those changes. Now, that the sex offender relief bill went into effect last session, but it's important to note that this bill is extremely limited on who it applies to. It only applies to adjudications that occurred after January, or crimes that occurred after January 1st of 2001 or 2002. So anybody who was adjudicated or whose crime occurred prior to that date is not, right now in Oregon, any juvenile is not eligible to receive relief from sex offender registration. So if their crime occurred in November of 2001,
we have another bill floating.
There is another bill. That's right. That deals with that because it is a significant problem. But it's also important to note that the Dreyer case and the Tyree case that were mentioned by Mr. Livingston and Ms. Holmes-Hain both were decided before the legislature spoke and put in this new sex offender relief from registration legislation. I have noticed a change in the judges in Multnomah County on how they are dealing with sex offender and sex offender cases. They like the new process. They like the fact that factors are put out, and they like the way it's structured with a presumption that the juvenile should receive relief from registration. You are not seeing judges on cases that are eligible for relief from sex offender registration under the new legislation doing this end around. I think there was a feeling when I was listening to the testimony that that the committee was given the thought that the judges are still doing this. They aren't doing it for kids that are eligible for the new relief from sex offender registration. The other thing that's important to note is expunction was not put in to limit the court's ability to restrict or give juveniles a relief from registration. Expungement was put in first. The crimes were made non-expungible first, and then juveniles were required to register. So it wasn't that expungibility was trying to stop the court from trying to get around the registration requirements, as Ms. Holmes-Hain said, because non-expungibility came first. When the courts were trying to get around the registration acts, there were many ways. You know, there's 36 counties, and as most other things in Oregon, if you go to a juvenile court in any county, it's not going to look too much like a juvenile court in any other county. There's 36 different ways of doing things. There are many other ways that judges have used to get around sex offender registration because of their concern about saddling a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, or even a 17-year-old with lifetime registration and what that requires. Now, neither the Tyree case or the Dreyer case said that those cases got around expungibility. That's still an open question in Oregon. And I would note that there has not been any juvenile who has gotten their petition dismissed either through the 610 method or through the 261 method who has requested expungement. If there was, that case would be up on appeal right now, and we would know about it. They haven't requested expungement. They have requested relief from registration, which this legislature has decided is a policy choice that we should be giving juveniles, and for a very good reason. The flexibility that's required in juvenile court is required for all cases, not just sex offender cases. Senator Walker asked whether this 219C 261 sub 2 process was used on any cases other than sex offender cases, and it is. There are cases that are adjudicated in juvenile court, and the court hears the trial, and I've had judges say, you know, okay, yeah, technically this kid committed an act which would have been a crime if they were an adult, but oh my gosh, this is one of the stupidest things I've ever seen prosecuted, and I'm not putting the kid on probation for that, so I'm just dismissing this petition, and I'm going to dismiss it because I don't think this should be on this kid's record. Did the kid do something wrong? Yeah, but it was the ultimate stupid kid thing to do, and it was just a stupid kid thing, and it was not a kid thinking criminally. And the court has used that to kind of rein back some prosecutors who think that everything a kid does which would be a crime if they were committed by an adult should be prosecuted in juvenile court and should be punished in juvenile court. And I've had judges say to prosecutors, you know, we have limited resources and I'm not going to spend the limited resources on this kid versus kid who are best friends who just got into a stupid fight one day at school, you know, and neither kid wanted to prosecute it because the victim didn't want their best friend in trouble and the best friend didn't want to get the victim in trouble. And, you know, so they were just brought into the system. The families were best friends. The parents had dealt with it appropriately by disciplining the kids appropriately, but yet the juvenile court still felt that they needed to step in. And that's when judges, in those cases, the judges have said, we don't need any more.
Kathy, help me understand. Do juvenile judges not have, like, pretrial settlement conferences or, I know that goes on in circuit court?
Chairman, I can't speak to what happens in all 36 counties. I know in the counties that I have practiced in, I've not participated in any pretrial conferences. I mean, we always have the opportunity to go to the court before trial and talk in chambers.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I'm getting to. I know a lot of adult felony cases are resolved in settlement conferences with the judge, and I'm sure there's a free flow of information between the DA and the defense attorney, and I mean, the defendant oftentimes is present there too. So
it's not a standardized practice. There is the opportunity to do that,
So, I mean, you know, when you get to the point where the judge is saying this really is not suited for trial, you assume that they would arrive at that decision at a settlement conference and resolve it with the prosecutor saying, you know what, I really think you ought to dismiss the petition or whatever.
I have had that happen at a settlement conference, Mr. Chair, and I've also had those cases where the judge has dismissed it where we did not have a settlement conference ahead of time. And I can remember the case, and I can remember a judge saying this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen, right. But I can't remember why we didn't have a settlement conference today.
Yeah, I mean, this whole issue really assumes that you're in the middle of a trial or you're at the end of a trial, and the judge then says, gee whiz, I just don't think this was appropriate. We shouldn't have gone through this, but that could be resolved with a settlement conference.
But it certainly can be, and it can be resolved at a settlement conference any time during the trial,
right,
if the judge wishes that.
Right, okay.
That's correct.
Right, sorry
Mr.
for
Chair.
Interrupting you.
It's okay.
Were you done or you got more?
I shouldn't say that to Kathy.
She usually comes in with like a truckload of briefs and stuff.
When you look, I think the important thing that the committee should consider is that the reason that the proponents have said we need this is because to deal with what the judges are doing on the juvenile sex offenses. I think that actually the legislature has gone a long way to resolve this problem and make sure that the standard and the way that juvenile sex offenses are dealt with around the state is uniform and has some standards to it by the passage of the legislation last session and certainly the bill that's coming forward this session, which expands the relief from registration bill. I think that this is a fix that is looking for a problem right now, because I think the legislature has already solved the problem that the proponents are talking about when it relates to juvenile sex offenses. It's an additional problem when they're trying to limit the court's ability to work and look at abuse individually and fashion an individualized disposition for a youth, which is what juvenile court is supposed to do, on other cases, because it's not this limitation on judicial discretion is not just limited to sex cases. I don't know if I can tell you a case where it would be the most appropriate thing after a youth gets off probation for a judge to do this, but I think there may be a case where it is appropriate, and I can't give you the fact pattern of that case where it's not a sex offense, but I don't think limiting the court's discretion, if the judge believes that that is what is in, and the court has to look at not just the best interest of the child. We got rid of that. It is protection of society now that the court is concerned about when they look at rehabilitation and other things, along with what is in the best interest of the child. So they have to look at both those things according to the preamble of the juvenile code when they're making their decisions and construing the statutes of the juvenile code. And I think the judges have been doing that with the concerns that the proponents bring up with the sex offenders with the new bill.
All right. Thank you. Ingrid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Kathy certainly covered most of the things I would like to say, but I guess the main impetus for this kind of proposed legislation is the tension that exists between the authority of the district attorney's office in our counties and the courts. And, of course, the district attorneys like to control as much of that process as they can, and in the criminal area, currently, that control is pretty broad-based, and they are accustomed to basically deciding the outcomes of cases by the charges that they bring. So they have a lot of control over the criminal process. The legislature has given the juvenile court judges significant discretion over the years, and the court has recognized the breadth of that discretion by basically affirming the power of the juvenile court to take special actions with respect to juvenile cases. Some district attorneys resent that. They want control over that process similar to the control they have in the criminal area. I think the application is much broader than sex offense allegations, but it's important there because these are serious charges with serious implications, and so most of the litigation has been in that area, but that's not the the only area of tension. The sex offender adjudication system basically does label for life anyone at this point who is adjudicated on any kind of sex offense, no matter how minimal it is. And there are certainly some very severe and serious sex cases, but there are also some very minor ones. And expungement is not available for any of them ever under current law. So that's part of the problem. And then, of course, when registration was added as another requirement for juveniles, incidentally, many states do not require juveniles to register at all. Oregon was one of the ones who decided to do that in response to federal legislation, but the federal legislation does not require it for juveniles. It requires it only for adults. And when the legislature did that, they went all the way and required lifetime registration for juveniles. You know, we were grateful last session to see some improvement in that area for offenders whose offenses occurred after the 1st of January of 2002. Those kids do now have the ability to seek relief from registration. It's a process. They have to file a petition. They have to, you know, present evidence. The state has the burden of proof in those cases. But with respect to all the other offenders whose offenses occurred before January 1st of 2002, currently there is no relief for those youth. I wanted to just mention a couple of things. Ms. Holmes-Hain indicated that there are no 15 to 18-year-olds adjudicated for sex offenses. That's not correct, and I'm sure she didn't really mean to say that. For the serious offenses, felony sex abuse one and rape and sodomy and so forth, those are Measure 11 offenses. However, there's sex abuse two, sex abuse three, and other offenses for which 15 to 18-year-olds are treated as juveniles. And yes, there can be 16-year-olds who have inappropriate sexual contact with a 13-year-old who is more than 3 years younger, and that person is, you know, guilty of that sex offense, and it can be totally consensual. But that youth, if the adjudication occurred before January 1 of 2000, must register for life, and regardless of when the offense occurred, may not have that offense expunged. In the discussions that we've had with the District Attorney's Association and other interested parties in terms of sort of improving this whole picture, it's really been the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office who has declined to even allow us to discuss expungement for juvenile sex offenders. They have taken that off the table in these discussions. I think it's inappropriate to look at the court's role in this and say that they are somehow misusing their authority. I think, on the contrary, the court is doing exactly what the legislature intended for it to do, and that is to look at a case-by-case basis, determine where public safety interests are, where the interests of the youth and so forth are, and make a decision in every case. The fact that the state is unhappy with those decisions does not mean that the court is not fulfilling its appropriate function in these cases.
All right. Thank you very much. Nancy, you want to Trixie on up here and share something with us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the director of the Court Programs and Services Division in the State Court Administrator's Office. I just wanted to give you a little bit of background and just a couple of comments in response to Ms. Holmes-Hain's testimony. We have surveyed the judges on Senate Bill 114, as is the story of our life on a regular basis. We have a split of opinion among the judges. I do think it's very fair to say that if the bill went further, as Ms. Holmes-Haynes is requesting, we would have more problems with it. What we have done, we were caught unaware by this bill. Amy testified that no work group could reach consensus. I just want to make it clear to the committee that no work group was ever requested. So we were caught unaware by this bill. We have asked the Circuit Judges Association if they would like to take a position on the bill. We are hoping to hear from them soon. The other thing that was very clear...
Let me interrupt you for just a second. Would you ask, when you're doing a survey with the judges, the other issues that were raised by Mr. Livingston with respect to expungement and some other process questions, because it may be appropriate to try to deal with those issues.
That would be wonderful, Mr. Chair.
It seems that we ought to try to define some clarity if there's agreement.
That would be great. In response to Senator Walker's question, this is not only a sex crime issue. Based on the responses from the judges, it was very interesting to me to find out that as the community resources have been dwindling, some judges are using this discretion, and all the parties agree up front, to adjudicate a youth, place the youth in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority to gain access to treatment with an understanding, not a sex case, with an understanding that if the youth successfully completes that, they will dismiss that adjudication. So I think it's very dangerous to have this portrayed only as a sex crime issue. I have to agree with Ms. Swenson. I'm a little stunned that Amy would imply that the intent of the court is to end run the law the court is exercising its discretion on a case-by-case basis. It's up to you to decide how much discretion they have. The only other statement that Ms. Holmes-Hain made that I take issue with is the fact that the court is confused about this. The research is not clear. The court is not confused. The court simply does not agree with the district attorney's position in all these cases.
How can you make that statement when I think you just told me that you didn't have all the survey information and you had a split decision?
Well, what Amy's saying is the court is confused about, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I heard Amy to say is that the court was confused about whether or not there's a chance for these kids to be rehabilitated, whether or not there, you know, there is any risk in the future, and that was the issue that Senator Ringo.
I'm not sure that's what she was saying. At least I took it to mean that there's a lot of uncertainty with respect to the research, and there's a lot of developing research. And I know that to be a fact because when we developed 370, I know there was some outstanding research with respect to how do we label or define a predatory juvenile sex offender because the research was not very clear. That's the way I took it. So.
That's what I think.
All right.
Thank you, Mr.
Anything
Chair.
Anything else? All right. Mr. Livingston, you don't work too far from here, do you?
No, sir.
So you can come back on another day, I assume.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much. I think we're going to split for the rest of the day because I'm tired. My brain's working overtime here.
I'm
so.
Trying to get a cold.
All right. Anybody here who wants to testify can't come back tomorrow? Or Monday or Tuesday next week. Okay. With that, any other business before the committee? Not before the adjournment.